This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Our immediate action to preserve the life and livelihood of rural Sudanese community is absolutely crucial. The longer we take to respond, the more life we expose to the imminent threat of famine.
That's Adam Yao, the Deputy Food and Agricultural Representative in Sudan, on how hunger is expected to continue and get worse in that country. Details coming up. Also, the Court of ECOWAS says Niger's deposed President Mohamed Bazoum must be freed immediately. And we look at the hopes of the people heading into the DRC's elections next Wednesday. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight.
Somalia has been granted $4.5 billion in debt relief from its international creditors, according to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The deal will allow the poverty-racked Horn of Africa nation to develop economically and start new projects. It comes as part of a debt forgiveness program called the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, overseen by both bodies. Somalia's debt will fall from 64% of GDP in 2018 to under 6% of GDP by the end of this year. Marina Zucker-Marquis, a researcher at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS University in London, and a researcher with the Project Debt Relief for a Green and Inclusive Recovery, she says this deal does not mean the other poor African countries can expect something similar because Somalia's debt relief was in the work for years.
Actually, it's a very old deal. So the HIPEC initiative, it actually began in 1996. So over 30 countries participated in this initiative, but a few countries didn't finish. So Chad is one of them. And Somalia is one of them. So actually, we are seeing now is the completion of a process that for Somalia began 10 years ago.
This is a lot of money, though, even though it started a long time ago in the talks. Is this something that could possibly translate to other developing countries on the African continent, this kind of similar debt deal with the World Bank and IMF?
Actually, the World Bank, the IMF, and actually the shareholders of these institutions, like the advanced countries, they are very reluctant to do a HIPEC 2.0. So this is what our project claim we need to, because now are more than 20 countries that over 50% of their external debt payments is going to be to multilateral development banks. But they are reluctant to do a program similar to what we see today. So it would be the good type of policy, but there are very strong reluctance to do similar programs today. So unfortunately, we don't see this project, this initiative being repeated in the short term, at least.
Now, Somalia is, you know, a country that has been facing a lot of internal challenges, climate shocks, and this ongoing fighting and insurgency. You know, Al-Shabaab is still a big problem there. Is that in part why, you know, they were the banks were more interested in helping Somalia?
I think there may probably a combination of factors, but actually in 2020 the World Bank, the IMF, actually decided to give the next step and actually giving the debt relief within the HIPEC initiative, right? Because there are very many phases within the HIPEC. And in 2020, they were moving towards the completion point, that we say. But what actually determines when a country goes for this completion phase is when they fulfill a series of policies. So the country needs to have a poverty reduction plan. They need to be in the track for changing monetary stability, monetary policies. So actually, there are certain of conditions that the country needs to fulfill. So then they can be. So it's
kind of like benchmarks, you mean?
Yes, a series of benchmarks in terms of policies, yes.
What are some of these poverty reduction plans?
They change country to country, but the idea is that we need to invest in a certain amount to poverty reduction. You need to which is very tricky because these countries, they don't have much fiscal space to do it. So, yeah, there are a series of macroeconomic policies that need to, like, even central banking reforms that the country must fulfill.
That is Marina Zucker-Markey, a researcher at the SOAS University in London and a researcher with the project Debt Relief for a Green and Inclusive Recovery. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from London. United Nations food agencies warn of looming hunger catastrophe in conflict-ridden Sudan by next year's lean season without urgent, unimpeded food assistance to millions of acutely hungry people. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A new food analysis by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a very scientific evaluation of food security, released today warns 18 million people across Sudan face acute hunger. It says this is the highest level of hunger ever recorded during the current harvest season, a period when more food is available. United Nations agencies say ongoing conflict, escalating violence, low agricultural production, high food prices, climate shocks, and displacement are exacerbating the food crisis. Adam Yao is the deputy food and agriculture representative in Sudan. He says hunger in this war-torn country will reach new levels during the lean season in May, when food stocks are at their lowest. Speaking from Sudan's Sennar state, he told journalists that more financial support and unimpeded access to people trapped in conflict hotspots are needed to ward off the worst.
The Sudanese people require more support, more than ever. Our immediate action to preserve the life and livelihood of rural Sudanese community is absolutely crucial. The longer we take to respond, the more life we expose to the imminent threat of famine.
Today marks 8 months since rival generals from the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary support response forces plunged Sudan into a conflict described as one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The World Food Program says the war has unleashed terror, violence, displacement, and immeasurable suffering. Despite this, WFP spokesperson for Sudan, Lenny Kensley, says the crisis is not getting the international focus and attention that is warranted. Speaking from Nairobi, Kenya, Kensley says regular and safe humanitarian access to civilians in areas worst hit by violence is inadequate, as is international financial support for a crisis of this magnitude.
Since the start of the conflict, WFP has provided life-saving assistance to over 5 million people, preventing an even worse deterioration of food security, especially in eastern and northern Sudan. Yet this is only scratching the surface compared to the immense needs that we are seeing on ground.
WFP reports only 1 in 5 people most urgently in need of food assistance in the Khartoum area has received it since the conflict started. It says it has been able to provide food aid to 500,000 people from Chad to West and Central Darfur since August. However, it notes WFP has been unable to provide desperately needed food to people in other parts of Darfur since June. This because armed groups have refused guarantees of safe access to the volatile areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The war between Israel and Hamas means the economy in the West Bank is suffering. Employees of the Palestinian Authority have not been paid properly in weeks, and work permits for Palestinians working in Israel have been revoked, those being just two of the issues. In this report from Ramallah in the West Bank, Henry Wilkins speaks to tradesmen whose businesses have ground to a halt as commentators say the squeeze could lead to civil unrest.
In one of Ramallah's industrial zones, Abu Mohammed Yaqub, a metal fabricator who makes grills for windows and gates, says since the war started in October, customers have little money and checks from those who have put in orders usually bounce. He says prices from his suppliers have skyrocketed. Yaqub says no one can go to Israel for supplies because travel permits have been taken away. That's why products and raw materials are more expensive, he says. Anyone who still has stock from before the war is selling it at higher prices. Permits to work in Israel have been revoked too. According to the Palestinian Ministry of the National Economy, since October 7th, Israel has revoked travel permits for as many as 130,000 Palestinians who previously worked or did business in Israel, making it hard, if not impossible, for them to earn a living. Israeli politicians have cited security concerns over Palestinians entering Israeli territory as the main reason. But problems with the West Bank's economy due to the war do not end there. Because the West Bank does not control its borders, Israel collects import taxes on its behalf. Since October, the Palestinian Authority, which administers the West Bank, has refused to accept the tax payments in protest after Israel sought to withhold some of them due to the war in Gaza. Since then, the PA has not been able to fully pay employees, like Muafe El-Baghouti, who works in a department focused on countering Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Of course, the economic situation affects us, he says, but we have to cope with the conditions imposed by the occupiers. They say the policy is to avoid paying salaries for terrorist families, but this is an Israeli policy targeting every Palestinian. El-Baghouti says he has received only around 17% of his usual pay in the last 3 months. More Israeli checkpoints on the roads are causing problems too. Independent analyst Ismat Mansour says the impact of Israeli checkpoints is significant. It means agricultural products that need to be moved rot, and products are damaged and delayed. He says everything takes more time, gas and transportation expenses, making products unprofitable for Palestinians. On whether there's an end in sight to the West Bank's economic woes, one expert said Israel will likely have to let Palestinian workers back in eventually.
They're talking about starting from perhaps doing gradually different ages or doing more security checks. I'm not sure they're doing it at the right pace, but I think this is going to happen. How quickly? Let's see.
There's concern among political commentators that unless something is done soon to end the squeeze in the West Bank, it could lead to civil unrest and more security problems for Israel. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Ramallah, the West Bank.
Chad's military government says a majority of about 8 million voters are not ready to vote in Sunday's constitutional referendum that would pave the way for a return to civilian rule. A campaign for voter participation is taking place amid opposition and civil society calls for a total boycott of what they call a sham referendum. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
The National Commission charged with the organization of Chad's December 17 constitutional referendum, or CONOREC, says several million voters have not collected their voter cards less than 48 hours ahead of Sunday's referendum. CONOREC says that without voter cards, civilians who registered will not be allowed to vote in the referendum on a new constitution that sets the stage for elections and a return to civilian rule. Chad's military government this week said it had dispatched what it called friendly civil society groups, opposition parties, and government ministers to towns and villages to some 8.5 million voters, CONOREC says, are eligible to cast their votes on December 17. Brice Mbambum Gyotmbaye is a former presidential candidate and president of the opposition movement of Chadian Patriots for the Republic. He says a majority of civilians do not believe the referendum will pave the way for Chad's military ruler, Mahamat Idriss Deby, to leave power because he initially refused to hand power to a civilian government in October 2022 as agreed, and instead extended the transition period by 2 years. He says civilians are angry and refusing to collect voter cards that will enable them to vote in the December 17 referendum because Deby is intimidating opposition political parties and civil society groups that are against a constitution that maintains Chad as a unitary state with powers centered in the capital, N'Djamena. Gyotmbaye says many civilians want Chad to adopt a federal system end the dictatorship and the grip on power exerted by the Deby family on the country for 30 years. Mahamat Idris Deby came to power on April 20, 2021, following the death of his father Idris Deby Itno while fighting rebels in the north of his country. The rebels were fighting to end what they called Itno's 31-year-long autocratic rule. His son took power and promised to organize elections within 18 months, but instead extended his rule until November 2024. Civil society and opposition leaders say the referendum the military leader is organizing cannot be taken seriously because Deby rules with an iron fist and cracks down on freedom of speech and assembly. The opposition says CONOREC, the referendum management body, is partisan. Several dozen opposition parties and civil society groups are calling for either a no vote or a boycott of the referendum. Francois Gikonbe leads a yes coalition set up by Chad's military rulers to campaign for a vote for a new draft constitution, which the military junta says strengthens judicial independence and institutional reforms. He says claims that Deby does not want to leave power are unfounded.
For the first time, il y aura, l'Assemblée nationale.
Gikonbe says Chad will, for the first time since it achieved independence from France in 1960, have a national assembly and a senate to both legislate, vote laws, and control activities of government ministers. He says the constitution also reinstates presidential term limits of 2 5-year terms that was abolished by Chad's former president, Idris Deby Itno, before he died. Gikonbe said the new constitution gives all 23 regions that make up Chad greater financial autonomy in a decentralized system of government and the possibility of electing their local governors previously appointed by the central government in N'Djamena. Sunday's constitutional referendum will enable the junta to manage Chad's transition until presidential elections are held by October 2024. Chad's opposition says the constitution to be voted on Sunday does not bar Deby, a 39-year-old military general, from participating in Chad's 2024 presidential election. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Niger's deposed president, Mohamed Bazoum, must be freed immediately from detention where he has been held since July 26 coup, the Court of the Economic Community of West African States ordered today. It called for Bazoum's immediate and unconditional release and ordered that he be reinstated, according to the judge in the case heard in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Niger is currently suspended from ECOWAS. Other member states have in the past ignored rulings from the ECOWAS court. It is Mohamed Bazoum who represents the state of Niger. He remains president of the republic, the court ruling said, adding, there are constitutional rights that have been violated. Bazoum has been held in his presidential residence with his wife and their son since he was overthrown. In mid-September, the deposed president appealed to the ECOWAS Court of Justice to obtain his release and restore constitutional order in the country. It is a sad day for Voice of America and the South Sudan in Focus team. We lost our colleague, Charlton Doki, VOA's South Sudan in Focus bureau chief and reporter coordinator in Juba. He was killed in a motorbike accident in Juba last night. Since joining the South Sudan in Focus team as a reporter in 2009 and becoming our reporter coordinator and Juba bureau chief in 2012, Doki contributed immensely to the South Sudan in Focus show for many years. Doki was behind the scenes assigning stories, editing scripts, and being an unsung hero behind the South Sudan in Focus radio show. Recently, however, he began filling news from Juba again, and you could hear him on the show reporting on issues in South Sudan and Sudan. Some of us will remember him as a gentle mentor, a silent and humble bureau chief, and more. And for many of us here at VOA, he is most remembered as a friend. Today, We celebrate your legacy, my friend. Rest in peace. Here is a conversation we had with colleagues Carol Van Damme and Nabil Biagio about Charlton.
Charlton, to me, was more than a colleague. He was, of course, the bureau chief in Juba for our show, the South Sudan in Focus show. He was, in some ways, a mentor, but he was a friend. I knew him personally in Juba. We hang out socially. I knew his family. And so when the news hit, it was tragic. It was beyond tragic, especially the way he died in a motorcycle accident. I don't know how much more I can say, but yeah, I will leave it here.
Yeah, we're all shocked, Nabil. And basically, I knew Doki when he came for a brief visit to United States and was working here at VOA, here in our office. And basically, I was detailed from Africa News Tonight to host South Sudan in Focus. And we actually worked together and we actually walked together to the studio. He shadowed. He's a quick learner. He's an amazing journalist. And what a great personality. So I am really in shock, too. And their words cannot express my sadness.
I feel the same way as Yahya's just described. I got to take at least one trip to South Sudan and spent 2 weeks there. And, you know, I was asked to do some training with the reporters. And Charlton is the one that shepherded me around, of course. And I had already met him talking on the phone, and he had come to Washington, like Yahya said earlier, to work on the show and do some training. And also he co-hosted that show in the early years with John Tanza. And he was just such a great guy. Besides being a really professional editor, reporter, he stepped in when we needed him in Juba to be the editor beyond being a reporter. And he did a marvelous job. And it's not easy doing that job. You know, some of the reporters are better writers than others, but he had to just do some work on some of these scripts and then send them to us. And that's a thankless job. Not only that, but he would be the one that had to be in charge of making sure that we were covering all the breaking news in Sudan and South Sudan and you know, just be on top of things and assign the stories. But what really moved me the most about Charlton is he never had a bad word to say about anyone, no matter how challenging the job could be sometimes. And he was just such a nice man and a gentleman.
He was an officer and a gentleman. Yes, that's true. He just a completely straightforward, upstanding person. Just you cannot. He kind of puts you at ease when you're with him.
Yes,
that's the kind of personality he exudes. Yes,
I agree 100%. And I worked with him from here in Washington. I worked with him in Juba when I was a stringer. He was always a humble and gentle person.
Exactly.
And really, just a pleasure to work with.
You know, and like I said, these guys, some of them and women, you know, they had some things to learn. But he always, you know, kind of guided them in such a gentle way and, you know, made them feel at ease, too. All these reporters that we had cycling through the Juba office. And then some of them came in for those workshops that we used to do in the early years. And, you know, he was a big part of that, too.
Absolutely.
It makes us think, like, you know, when the week started, you know, everything was fine with him and with all of us. And then all of a sudden, this happens and we lose him. So life is very fickle. That just makes us think how we should appreciate what we have.
Yeah. Really.
And with that sad note, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yahya Suhaib in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.